Mr. Cheeseman, reel 15.
About this particular tank, Mr. Cheeseman, the shells, did you have armour-piercing and high explosive?
Yes.
What was the proportion of one to the other used in the tank?
I never really never got down to that, but I would say it would be probably 50-50. Or probably more armour-piercing than in fact, I would say yes. Say two-thirds armour-piercing, one-third. I'm now not talking from experience, but talking from what obviously had to be, because those days it was tank versus tank.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, was it a tank versus tank situation?
We did, in fact, have infantry take part, enemy infantry as it were, but only occasionally. It was definitely, we were manoeuvring against each other, and holding somebody in his hold down position, whilst another section was going around and doing a flank on him and that sort of thing. Tank versus tank, which of course, HE is of no value whatsoever. Unless, of course, the tank breaks down and the fitters come along. Then he gets his head. Because if you can knock, I've said this before, knock out the fitters.
That's it, we've talked this before. Yes. Mm-hmm. What about smoke? Did you have smoke shells?
Yes. The Mark 6 light tank, which came on the sea, I think originally around about 1933-34, but came to my battalion in 1936. That was the very first armoured fighting vehicle that had a smog discharger on. Before that, in the headquarters squadron, we had a support section, i.e. was supposed to be three tanks, but we only had the one tank, which was not fitted with the three-pounder, but the 3.5 mortar. And it used to smoke mortar, of course. And the message had come along. I think I told you the joke about it last time. But the message come over the wireless, to go to such and such a map reference, and lay down a smoke screen between map reference such and map reference and so on, from 1150 hours to 1200 hours, and then retreat or something like that, or keep an eye on the direction of the wind and alter accordingly, that sort of thing. Yes, so each individual tank commander up to the advent of the Mark 6 light tank had no control over laying down the smoke screen. That was done by headquarters.
I always thought that the prevailing philosophy at that time on tank warfare was basically just an infantry support. This is one of the problems in the British Army, that there was that element that said it's infantry support and not...
In fact, you have quoted what was the idea of the vast majority of the army councils and what have you, that in fact the tank at one time was going to be done away with after the First World War. After all it was useful for was crossing trenches and crossing barbed wire. That was there. It was, I'm harping on about Brigadier Hobart, but he was the father of tank warfare. He realised that trench warfare had finished with the First World War.
So he was your brigadier, and basically he was training the brigade to be an anti-tank brigade, fighting against other tanks.
Yes, correct, yes.
As against infantry support, which other of the hierarchy here were obviously debating.
Before my time, in 1932, Brigadier Hobart, who had just been made a brigadier then, he instigated a big tank tactical battle, which covered the entire almost the entire area of Salisbury Plain. And in it, he had tank versus tank, tank versus cavalry. We had cavalry, and there was horses in the British Army when I was there. Tank versus infantry, and i.e. the whole gamut of what you could probably expect. He instigated. I was just reading it the other day. I was reading the book. In 1932, and my battalion, the 5th Battalion, took part in this. But you'll appreciate the fact that I would think 50% of his armour, I'll put that in inverted commas, his armour, was made up of the tankette. In other words, the great-grandfather of the Bren gun carrier, as it were. And you say, oh my goodness, but no, it was, he was exercising a tactical warfare. What the hell do you want with guns when you're exercising tactical? Oh yes, the fine analysis you do these things, but then you go down the road and learn how to hit the target every time.
So the tanks that you were manoeuvring in 1937 were meant to fight tanks. That's the point I was trying to get to. Yeah. And was it, obviously in the light of things to follow, it was a little bit behind the times in some respects.
It was quite useless. It was immediately. Yes, around about the time the war broke out, they said, right, you are medium tanks training.
But you were never aware of just how far behind they were at that time.
No, the medium tank. I mean, that's compared with the old Mark V's, the First World War, the medium tank was magnificent. That means that they were tin cans, really.
Were they very efficient tanks? Did they, I'm thinking mechanically.
By the standards of armoured fighting vehicles in those days, they were quite efficient, yes. But as I said, I'm talking about a 2,000 mile between complete overhauls. Now, if I can just mark that 2,000 miles, can I just jump ahead a bit? When we first went into the desert in 1940, 1941. Anyway, when we first went into the desert, our tanks were already half worn out. And yet, of course, we didn't have mediums then. We had the Crusader and the Christie Cruiser and what have you. And yet, we fitters kept those tanks going across the desert for another 700 to 800 miles before we came up against the immovable object, Rommel.
How much fuel did this tank that you were working with?
120 gallons of petrol will give you about 90 to 100 mile radius.
And you multiply that by the number of tanks you've got.
Yes.
And how was that supply maintained whilst you were, in your case, manoeuvring, but obviously later in action?
Oh, you see, on manoeuvres, of course, there was a petrol compound, in 2 gallon cans, by the way. Can you imagine 150 gallons per tank? But the old fashioned 2 gallon cans. In action, well, of course, logistics was the heart, the mind, everything of a tank battalion. Without your petrol lorry and your ammunition lorry and your fitter's workshop lorry.
But you were onto the Bowser lorry by that time and not 2 gallon.
We never ever had a Bowser. I'm telling you a fib. Between those 4 years of my peacetime service before the war broke out, we were subjected to umpteen different ideas and tests and what have you. We became guinea pigs for this, that, and t'other and what have you. You know the old the mustard gas eyes used for the. We tested those out, and originally they were tinted and they were so bright that they just about blinded you. But for 2 days we weren't allowed to take those off. And then we test. But I'm digressing there. But there was umpteen various things that we took part in. And we did, the battalion took delivery after about 1938 of 2 petrol Bowsers, but they were never used as such. We did, of course, have water Bowsers in the desert, but that's another story.
And how did shells get to you when you to replenish your shells? I know that we mentioned the fact that usually it was at night, yes. But in the normal course of events, you would need shells at other times than that.
Yes.
So how were shells got to you?
Well, that's in true action. Well, I'm jumping ahead now. The tank commander would know that he's running short of this or he's running short of that, and so he would let his section leader or company squadron commander by then know that he was running short, and so everyone would be known, and so they would try and manoeuvre battle conditions allowing into a holler. So that and then Radio White send a message back to air echelon, petrol lorry wanted or ammo lorry wanted. Very seldom did they ever get into a nice little safe hollow that one wouldn't fit as it was always stuck in. It was many men we could see it with that sod floor that.
How long in 1937, again with manoeuvres, and you were in the driving and operating situation, how long would you be in that tank for any one given time?
The longest period would probably be within the hour or something like that, because remember, we're on manoeuvres. I, no doubt, a regular tank crew, when they're going from point A to point B to start a battle, they'll be in many other. I would never. Here, I'm telling a blinking fib here. I was in the tank quite a lot. You see, what I was trying to say is that the regular the tank that I was in would have to go to such and such a point and maneuver and then go to another point. When they got that point, well, I could get out. The reason why I could get out was because I had all driver operators had a very, very long lead to my headphones, so I wasn't tied into the tank. And immediately the message came over, you clambered into the tank. So, occasionally I would message you'd be coming over when the tank had stopped, and therefore you'd be in the tank. But no, I wouldn't be in the tank much more than about an hour at a time. That's very seldom.
Temperature in the tank when it'd been running some time, wasn't it?
Boiling. The engine was air cooled, and the design of the tank was the ideas of that. Oh dear, how can I put it? Well, you'll appreciate the fact that when the first motor cars came out, they were horseless carriages. In other words, they weren't a motor car, they were an extension from what was on previous. Well, our tanks were an extension from previous as designed, and therefore the engine had to be in the front, because all engines were in front those days, and the driver was in front alongside there, and so on. And it was in a separate compartment. You had an engine compartment, and you had to be able to get in from one to the front fighting compartment to the engine compartment. And how ridiculous can you get? But nevertheless, that's how it was. Now, another Sod's law was that the catch to that engine compartment, you was always loose, and it would always shake loose. And that, I said the engine was air cooled. The cooling fan, it would be nearly 2 foot across, and it was not the fan that you see in a car. It was a proper voluted fan, very high, and it created a colossal amount of pressure. Now it'd come down and cool the cylinders, and there was louvers in the top of the engine compartment to allow the air out, which was far too small. Anyway, the engine compartment would be pressurized. The door would rattle open, and you'll get a blast of air which was far, far hotter than anything I ever experienced in the desert. The tanks those days were not designed with anything to do with ergonomics. The human didn't enter the human equation didn't enter the designers.
Yeah, you were saying that nothing pivoted. You had to walk around it or maneuver around it.
And can you imagine in a small, what would it be, about 5 foot diameter is the turret, right? Now you're in that, and everything's closed down. The tank commander can see out, the gunner can see out, and of course the driver can see out, but the gun loader and the wireless operator couldn't see out. Now the gunner is turning his turret to the left. How far? Well, I don't know. Can you tell how far in the dark? And then he would turn it to the right. Has it come back to the front again? You got completely disorganized. Because you saw you could feel yourself when you're going forward. In a tank, you felt when it...
Could you get used to that in time?
Oh, yes, you got used to it, yes. The noise was colossal. It really was,
So long journeys would be bearing down on you pretty hard.
Absolutely. Plus the fact that it was physically hard work. I did that first time on a... I wasn't a tank driver, so they didn't issue me with the driver's essentials, which is the gauntlets. And the tank driver, the regular, he's not going to give his gauntlets up. So I drove a tank for about half an hour, and I was beginning to get blisters on my hands. But there was no servo nose there. It was muscle, We know the mechanical advantage of levers and what have you, but nevertheless, it was really, really hard work. Oh, the other thing as well was that getting into the driver's seat, you opened the back rest of the driver, this is getting in from inside the tank, open the back rest of the driver, clamber in over the seat, put your legs down to where your pedals are, and pull the seat behind you and lock it. And of course that catch was always, and if you're pushing your clutch out hard, or you were hand-braking it, if that door opened, and it did occasionally, immediately behind your head was armoured plate. Oh!
How much view had the driver?
As much as he liked, actually.
I'm going looking forward.
Yeah. Well, you have the visor up, and
his head was just.
Just his head, in fact, up to his mouth. And so he could see almost 180 degrees from his left to his right. But he could not see anything within, say, 12 foot, 15 feet of the front of the tank. That was gone to him. So that if you were on the road, there was always someone standing outside on the running board, not telling him, because you can hear that always, hand signalling. You get a hand signal in front of you.
And with the visor down?
With the visor down, it had two options. It could slide the slit across, which would be an inch wide, and about 6 inches long. One to his right, one directly in front, and one to his left. And he could close them, and you had pinholes. You could see surprising amount of pinholes, believe me. But now, again, I talked about the Mark VI light tank being the first one to have the smoke mortar. It was also the first tank to have what we call protector scopes. You know how a submarine periscope is with angled mirrors? Well, if you can squeeze the periscope right away down so that you're looking out, the mirror that's looking out is a mere couple of inches above the mirror that you're looking into, that was a protector scope. And incidentally, it was one solid block of perspex. First time I ever saw this stuff, by the way. I don't know, there would be perspex in there. There might be celluloid or something. But anyway, that was it. And also, a variation of that was the majority of these tanks, the protector scope was about five thicknesses of about it. 3/4 inch thick of bulletproof glass, and you slid that in. You had spare ones, and you open it, and you just look through that. Now, a good sniper could fire at that, smash the glass, wouldn't come through, smash the glass, whereupon you'd shoot your visor off, take the broken one out, and put a fresh one, open your visor, and you'd carry on again.
Hatches for getting in and out. Obviously, is the one at the top of the turret.
Yeah, the Vickers medium tank, by the way, was designed. I thought it was rather humane of the designer. It had a big a door at the back. I would say 2.5 foot wide and probably 4.5 to 5 foot high. Quite big. The reason for that is that it was easier to get wounded, a stretchered wounded man out of the tank. I thought, at least someone was human in those days. But I couldn't see a stretching beam got in there. So the Vickers medium had this big back door, and it was invariably used. Even the driver wouldn't get in through his. He was able to do so, but it was far easier to get in through this door. When the light tank came along, of course, the driver got in. Well, it was a huge area for the driver to get in and out. The armour from his waist to his feet. He's sitting in a racing car, his feet are straight forward. The armour between his waist and his feet would hinge forward away from him, and his visor from his waist, the armour protection from his waist up to above his head with all the visor, would open up backwards, and you'd get in and out that way. The tank commander and the gunner in the Mark VI, they did use a turret.
Was the tank of 1937 well armoured by comparison of the anti-tank weapons that may be ranged against it?
Well, the short answer is no. Although, putting myself back into 1937, and I wasn't alone in this, it's the finest time in the world, We now, in hindsight, we now know that the Vickers medium tank wouldn't have lasted 2 seconds in the war that was about to come along. In fact, one also talking about this, he called his story the boilerplate war, referring to the armoured tank, and I think that puts it in a nutshell. I can't say that it wasn't armoured plate, I think it was armoured plate, but could be much more than about 5/8 of an inch thick. which of course is ridiculous. Oh, by the way, this medium tank, we still, in those days, we still had on the inside of the fighting chamber asbestos cladding. Because of the First World War, a high explosive shell, not a pre-hitter, high explosive shell would bend the armour of the tank, and splinters of steel would fly off and blind or really seriously wound them inside. And so they tried various things, but the asbestos cladding was fitted there. I wonder if I've got asbestosis.
Where was the petrol tank which held the fuel?
At the back of the tank. I think there's a little bit of thought went in there. The tank's going forward, and that's the part that's going to get hit. So it was at the back of the tank. If you have a picture of the old medium tank, it's very box-like, and the back end drops away sheer. That's because immediately behind that is two conventional tanks, petrol tanks. Each containing 60 gallons of petrol each.
And any other weapon on the tank other than the 3-pounder gun?
The 3-pounder gun was mounted with the 3-pounder gun was the .303 Vickers machine gun, water cooled, coaxially. In other words, the gun layer, the gunner of the tank, had the one sight for the 3-pounder gun and also the machine gun. Of course, the tank commander, he's forever looking round to see what. Okay, there's an anti-tank gun over there. Fair enough. So he gives the message to his speaking tube to the gunner. Gun 10 o'clock. Anti-tank gun. Fire. And then whilst he's probably looking, he's knocked an anti-tank gun out. In the meantime, the tank commander sees some infantry over here. So, right, you are gonna, 2 o'clock, gun order, what the message, well, for the machine gun. And so, the machine gun will be used, and the gun himself will be still using the same.
So he could fire both guns at the same time, is that
no,
basically?
No. Just one or the little lever. No, it's one or the other. Now, if the situation was where the main gun had to be used, but we could do with a spray of a machine gun somewhere, the hole guns came in here. And by the way, that hole gunner, he was the only one that had to scramble one from one side of the tank to the other, i.e., the targets on the right-hand side of the tank, the tank commander's command would say anything, the position would be anything from, say, 2 o'clock till 5 o'clock. That's that range on there. Or if it was from 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock, it's the left-hand side of the tank. So the old tall gun is firing away on the right-hand side, and then suddenly the tank commander says, right, you are holding a 9 o'clock. Drop that gun, clamber across the tank the other side, pick up the other inside it and fire there. And can you imagine that with crawling between the wireless operator's legs, if the wireless operator can uncross them whilst he's been waltzing sideways on, dug down because he couldn't get past the deflector arm of the 3-pounder recoil gun. And also, of course, the tank commander's legs, and get over. We were very good in those days, you know.
And this was another weapon in addition to the machine gun on the turret.
I'm now talking about the Vickers Medium Mark II. The 3-pounder, the 303 machine gun coaxial, and then on the right hand side, the 303 machine gun, and on the left hand side 303 machine gun.